Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Modern Mind with myself, Fergus Crawley, and nobody else today. I am sincerely apologetic for the lack of guest innovation. But nonetheless, I'm going to break down what was a rather life-changing, profound experience for me, which was running 250 kilometers in one go. I have 273 questions from different platforms to choose from today. I have them in front of me now. I'm going to choose them as I go and speak from the heart. I haven't prepared for this, so I want to keep everything raw, emotional, and reflective because I'm still unpacking a lot of this process myself. So without any further ado, let's dive into today's 250 kilometer Q&A. Okay, so question number one is from Rowan Hansen 98, favourite hallucination. On the Devil's Staircase, a section from King's House to Kinlochleven, up and over the hill, descending down into it, I had Johnny supporting me in the middle of night number two. On the way up, I saw a couple of rocks in the middle of the trail, one of which I thought was an otter, the other one I thought was a badger. And then things got a little bit weirder because I saw a few rocks with some like white, I don't know, moss, geological stuff on them that looked like that girl from The Ring, and was like, and I kind of panicked a little bit because it looked like a hunched over little girl that was going to sort of do horror movie stuff to me. And then I realized it was just a rock with a white topping on it. So that was that. And then not far after that, I saw a big rock on the side of the hill that I thought was a whale. So to say that reality was becoming a little bit odd is fair, but I'd say for the sheer weirdness of it, that was my favourite set of hallucinations. Not quite as bad as the Double Brutal in terms of how weird things got. I don't know what the difference with that was. Maybe it's a little bit more experience. Maybe it was the fact that I had support with me for longer sections. I don't know. But hallucinations weren't quite as mental as they were in the past, but they were still pretty weird. Question from Dan Oh, Beaumont, did you ever doubt yourself that you'd finish? Yes. So I think when I came to the end of the canal and I was starting to feel pretty beaten up because of the concrete, because of the loneliness, because of the long first section, basically the first third of the whole thing, I was really struggling to comprehend and piece together how I would actually be able to get through the rest of that on the set of legs that I had. Then we entered a section of path where Jamie was supporting me that was like a bog when it normally wouldn't be. And that sapped my legs, activated all the tiny little muscles that I had to use to stabilize myself through ankle deep mud for about 2.5 hours. And then when I got to Drimmen, I felt absolutely destroyed and had 140K to go. So couldn't quite logically piece together how I was going to get this done. That sort of peaked at 151 kilometers where I sat down with my head in my hands and then got myself together, moved things forwards through to Inverannon. And then from that moment onwards, it started to make sense to me how I was actually going to be able to segment this out and see it through to the finish. I never actually doubted my ability to get it done per se, but it just didn't make sense when I was in it how I could feasibly get section by section by section by section. So it was difficult not to get overwhelmed by what was remaining, even though I'd done all of the sort of mental preparation that I could to take that on. But ultimately, that's where the mystery lies. Another question from Dan Beaumont, what would you have done differently? So first of all, I would have prepared mentally a lot more for the canal. I got a little bit complacent with it in my head. I didn't really give it the respect it deserves ahead of time. I went into it thinking that because it's the first third, because it's flat, because it's on concrete, because I know it really well, because it's familiar, because it's going to be in the daytime, it's not going to be all that challenging. When in reality, it's 86K along a flat section that I was going to be moving at the quickest and most consistent pace of the whole thing. So realistically, it beat me up. 86K on concrete is going to hurt no matter how conditioned you are. It's what happens next that is kind of where that becomes relevant. But I didn't give it the time of day in my head mentally to really G myself up and prepare for it, which meant that when I was in the sort of third, fourth quarter of it, I started to let my mind get the better of me a bit. I was on my own, and that started to put me into a bit of a spiral I had to fight my way back from. I think had I prepared for that a little bit more psychologically ahead of time, it wouldn't have knocked me mentally going into night one as much as it did. So that's on me. That's something that I would have done differently in my preparation. And then I think stoppage time, we would have cut a little bit shorter, but with a lot of the things that changed along the way, like the bogginess, like the rain, like the sections that really caught me off guard, like when the pain was more intense than I expected to be on a certain section, there were points where I just needed an hour or so to reflect, reset, and move forwards again. And I don't think I would have got to the finish without doing that. So would I have reduced the stoppage time? Yes. Did I value the stoppage time that I had to keep things moving forwards? Yes. So exactly what the timelines would have been, I don't know. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. So that is that. Question from Nickel 8 Nickel. At what point when you felt you could go no further, what was your internal conversation? So this point came twice, 151 kilometers and 190 kilometers. Those were the two moments where I really did not have any understanding of how I was going to be able to move things forwards, physically or mentally. I felt destroyed, defeated, and not even like I'd bitten off more than I could chew, but just I lost my ability to theoretically understand how I could actually move forwards. It wasn't like a ability thing per se or preparation thing. It was just a tired confusion as to why and how I was in this situation, if that makes sense. So 151K, I sat down for about 10 minutes and had my head in my hands, north end of Loch Lomond. Jamie was doing his best to sort of pep talk me, but I just needed a moment to myself to get my head together, to get to the next section, to get to the next stoppage point so that I could reconnect with the team, get some food on board and move things forwards. Mentally, I can't remember the internal conversation, but I know what I was trying to do was simply calm myself down. And then once I was in a bit of a clearer headspace, I could default to my plan, which was to segment each section and just think A to B, A to B, A to B, A to B, not A to Z with the whole thing. So that then happened at 190K on Rannoch Moor as well, but that's where pain in my feet and just general existence was quite high. And I went through the same process again, but that was when emotions and physical pain really, really peaked on night two. And every 20, 30, 40, 50 meters, give or take, I was having a minor meltdown, to which Jamie, sitting behind the camera, can attest to. So I lost the ability to rationally understand how I was going to be able to keep moving forwards. So every 30, 40 meters on that section was the A to B. The segment remaining, the 3-4K remaining at that point of that section became irrelevant. It was the next 30, 40 meters. And then I had to put my head down on my poles, lean forward, maybe do a little bit of a dramatic scream. Like if anyone's seen Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where it's Mac Day, they each get one loud scream into a pillow to, you know, express themselves during their misery. And that's kind of how I felt. I didn't have a pillow, so if there were any campers nearby, sorry. But the mental dialogue there was very negative. If I'd been on my own, I may well have thrown in the towel at that point. I'd like to think that I wouldn't, but that was the closest that I felt to this being impossible and where I had the least amount of faith in my ability to actually get things done. And whilst Jamie's support wasn't really actually helping me, sorry, Jamie, it probably actually very much was, even just his presence was probably very useful. But yeah, the mental dialogue was just trying to get to King's House because that's where Erin and the dogs were going to be for the first time, which was going to be a real big morale boost for me. So all I was trying to default back to was section by section, segment by segment, A to B, A to B, A to B. So getting to B was to King's House, which at this point was about 4 or 5K away. So break it down into 100 meter gaps, whatever it was at the time, and go from there. Question from Stuart_Greg. How do you keep the watch alive? So I have a watch with a fairly decent battery life anyway, but I put it on ultra mode, which means that it pings off the GPS a little bit less frequently, which extends the battery life. And then whenever we got to stops where we knew we were going to have 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, we just put it on a portable charger for that period of time, which meant that we were constantly topping it up. And actually, after the first big stop at Mulgai, the charge that we gave it for an hour there basically saw it through the whole thing. We did a sort of precautionary top up towards the end, but it needed a full charge and then 45 minutes of supplementary charge to see it through. So if you are going to be doing things that are 2 days long, then it's probably worth investing in a watch that allows you to do that without too much friction. I used to, with the older models, with the old chargers, I used to be able to connect it to a portable charger that I'd have in my backpack with the watch in it, connect it, leave it in my backpack, and then I'd still get all the data, aside from cadence would be a little bit off, but by having a heart rate strap, I'd still get live heart rate data within the GPS file, but the watch would be in my back, and then I could take it back off and put it back on my wrist when it was charged. But the way that charges on those devices are now, you can't do that without it coming out. So yeah, whenever I had a stop, portable charger, topped it up. So in the future, maybe if you're looking at something like this, you could have a portable charger in your trail bag, you could carry a charger with you, and when you're at an aid station for 10, 15 minutes, plug it in quickly, give it a little boost, and that'll keep topping up as you go. Question from Jake Finner Silver. What was the funniest thing that happened? So it didn't actually happen to me. That wasn't much funny for me, really, on this. There was. The support team got loopy. We all got loopy. It got weird. It was good fun, upon reflection. But the funniest thing that happened was, in fact, that the support team along the canal got a flat tire on a Friday afternoon when everybody was looking forward to closing shop for the weekend, and the Defender that they were driving needed a very specific tire. So they were flapping like mad, not to my knowledge, as they did a very good job of keeping it to themselves, trying to find a spare tire that could keep them moving forwards and keep effectively supporting me in the one car that they currently had, because we were going one car from Edinburgh to Glasgow and then two cars from Glasgow up towards Fort William. And they kept it discreet. They managed to find a solution with a very, very kind local garage man in Ratho. His name is featured and thanked profusely in the video, the main video on the channel. So that was quite hilarious to be told that behind the scenes, things were going drastically wrong and I was blissfully unaware. So well done, support team, for one, getting a flat tire, two, managing to fix it, and three, keeping me uninformed, because that probably could have affected my mood at the time. Other than that, the only real funny thing that happened, actually, no, I'll take back what I said earlier. The whole thing was hilarious, but the thing that I reflect on as the funniest from the whole event was, came into Tindrum, expecting to have a sort of late lunch at the Green Welly, which is the last stop before you get to Glencoe, and go in and the sort of cafe's closed. They go into the smaller cafe and they're not in there. I'm thinking, fucking hell, what have they done? Are they not here? Have I been too quick for this section? And then I see Johnny sort of pop his head up over a wall a bit further away and beckon me over. I'm thinking, what's going on here? And I come around the corner to see them all sat on a picnic bench with a steak pie and chips waiting for me at the, I think it was the Tindrum Inn, it was called, and everybody that wasn't driving had a pint. And I thought, well, this is just like a weird lad's holiday sort of thing. I was then informed that one of the picnic bench slats, planks that was sort of on the top was loose, and Elliot, who was one of the support crew and our editor, put his pint down, went to sit down, put his elbows down and just poured and catapulted his pint all over himself. So as I was tucking into my steak pie and chips before the next big section, as we were entering the sort of darkness of night two, I thought, you know what? If I don't take a moment to appreciate bits like this, then what's the point in doing all this? So it was good to just have a bit of a morale boost where we felt like we weren't doing a 250-kilometer ultra for about 20 minutes at a time, as Elliot sheepishly made his way back to the bar to be like, your picnic bench has covered me in Guinness. Would you mind getting me another one? So these things get weird, they're very entertaining, and at the end of the day, the experience that we've all had together going through this is where I really see the value from a personal point of view. Making the video, covering the distance is all just a bonus. At the end of the day, we had a very weird, very good time, albeit in a very much type 2 fun sort of way. Question from TL Besh, what's next? So I know what's next. I know a few things along the way towards what's next, but you are going to have to wait and see until I announce what's next. Will probably be the YouTube title in a couple of weeks. We have a lot of exciting plans to really activate our community over the summer, which I want to be a part of. I really want to sort of engage with and really send the message that individual progress is the main thing. What I will say is that I'm going to move back towards some sort of speedier road running stuff. And the exact events that will make up the rest of my year and the sort of focus of my training and content, I guess, will all be revealed very soon. Question from Issa Clocks. What do you think is driving the growing interest in extreme endurance sports? I think, could get quite profound about this, but I think an increasing disconnection from a sense of fulfillment in our day-to-day lives is forcing people to look for adversity on their own terms that they can find fulfillment from in the process of training for something that scares them out with their day job, family life, etc. A concept that I think really hammers this home is the concept of a third space. Most of us have a work life, a personal life, and then what we're missing is a third space, which is our sort of us time, our me time. And if we can find one, for a lot of people it's the gym, for a lot of people it's their road bike, for a lot of people it might be their pottery club, whatever it might be. Finding a third space and then committing to the process of improving and working towards progress-driven goals within that third space is a very fulfilling process. And I think in the modern world, it's becoming increasingly difficult to find low-hanging fruit fulfillment that really makes us feel like we are serving ourselves as best we can in our day-to-day lives, because the value of money is becoming less dominant than it once was. Our work hours are going up, commute times are going up, things are getting more difficult, geopolitics is increasingly catastrophic in terms of reporting and media, and if you get sucked into these things, it's easy to feel like you're just going through the motions and sort of in a bit of a monotonous day-to-day. And I think that's why people are looking for things that take them away from that, where they can find peace, where they can push themselves, where they can learn lessons about themselves, so that they can find progress and fulfillment out with the day-to-day. And whilst we all have very different day-to-days, and I don't want to make any assumptions, I would assume, and from a lot of the conversations I have with people that join us at Omnia, that it's something along those lines. I think what's really cool as well, speaking from a parental point of view, is a lot of people that come to us for one-to-one coaching with Omnia get to a point in their lives where they just really want to be able to continue to do fun things for themselves and with their children for as long as they possibly can. And I think generationally, we're working against the sacrifice your health in the short term for long-term pension contributions and retirement plans so that people can be a little bit more present and enjoy the journey towards later life a little bit more. It's something I massively buy into. I think experiences along the way are what make life worth living in many ways. And if we delay that too much for into the future, then we could end up being like my parents' generation, where they all have a set of fancy crockery that never really gets used because it's only for special occasions, but the occasions are never quite special enough. So that's my take. Feel free to agree or disagree. Please comment if you're watching on YouTube, or drop me a DM or put it in the Q&A if you're listening on Spotify. Really interesting question, so thank you. And that's actually forced me to think on my feet a little bit, which I think is something I always enjoy doing. Question from SpeedJake00. Did you meet anyone along the way who helped keep you going? Yes, absolutely. And I really want to use this opportunity to say thank you to everybody that popped up along the way to just say hello. There was a live tracker. We didn't actively say, please come and say hello. Please come and give me moral support. Please come and run with me. Essentially, we didn't want the logistical demand of having to manage that alongside the team and myself. So we just decided to keep it internal, so to speak. But along the canal, there are about 14 people. Sorry, along the whole thing, there are about 14 people that popped up along different ways. Along the canal, there were people that were there at early stages of the start. Somebody ran with me for about 5 minutes just to sort of say hello and then sort of turn around. A couple of people turned up with Omnia t-shirts that they were waving along the way. One guy absolutely burst himself to get to a bridge over the canal through a boggy bit to say hello, which was a really, really good rejuvenating bit for me, because it was when the heat was going up a little bit. My bladder, not my actual bladder, my water bladder on my back had leaked all over me, so I didn't have any fluid. So I was consciously moving quite slowly so not to sweat too much without any fluids. So I wasn't panicking, but I was thinking, oh, this isn't ideal. And then he popped up with an Omnia t-shirt, clearly out of breath from having worked hard to get there. He's been to a few of our Run Club events that we've done out of the office. So it was just really good to see that buy-in. Made me a little bit emotional at the time along the way whenever anyone came up, because it's just really, really cool. And I love having conversations with people along the way. There was a guy that came down in a meaty 4x4 on a very inaccessible road on this section between Tindrum and Bridge of Orkney, just to say hello. Young lad that's a very good cyclist, has done one endurance event, did 24 hours on Zwift, and we were just chatting about that for 5 or 10 minutes. And the section from there, when I spoke to him to Bridge of Orkney, just as night was coming in, was probably the best that I felt since the first 10K of the whole thing. So just goes to show how much morale boost really can give you, but also how much of a value add that human interaction, contact and support can be on things like this. So massive thank you to everybody that came and said hello. And then final thing I want to say is Mike from La Carba Mountain Rescue. Haven't seen Mike in person since Project Vertical in 2020, when he was a huge, huge help. We've communicated a lot since then, but he is part of an incredible team up in Fort William that look after the gnarliest section of mountains in the UK, and they have the highest call out rate of anywhere in the UK. And Mike's always been really bought into what we do, the messaging around it, and it was just great to see him at Ben Nevis car park at the end just to have a chit chat. And again, it just felt like a fun weekend out at that point. I was seeing people that I like to see, I was enjoying chatting to them, and it disarmed the pain and demand of the situation. So yeah, definitely some people along the way that made a big difference. Another question from SpeedJake00. What aspect of training did you struggle the most with? Volume, timing, scheduling, prioritizing. Been a very, very busy period for the businesses for valid reasons or positive reasons. We're growing effectively, got people coming on board, got the office development ongoing. And I've been more drawn to my desk work than I have been training for the past 6 months. And I think that's because of the chaos of this place and the fact that I've got a very clear sort of boundary between work and home now, where I come in here and I'm working. Having the gym there is great, but it means you can quite easily, you don't need to plan around rush hour. You don't need to plan around peak times. You don't need to plan around this and that, which just instinctively, subconsciously gives me a little bit of a negotiation with myself that can happen if I need to get a work task done before I get my training done. And then what I can end up doing is pushing it a bit late and then not enjoying the training process, because I know I'll always get the training done, but instinctively, for whatever reason, I've been prioritizing actual desk work or business related work. And what I had to do along the way was just really force myself to diarize and block time and basically take myself away from access to laptop and desk and everything so that I could get specific training sessions done. That's why things like a trip up to Glencoe with the team, where we went up for two specific new routes and things, was really, really valuable. I will admit as well, all of the long distance, steady state endurance routes around me that are within 20, 30 minutes aren't quite as fulfilling, as valuable as they used to be, because I've been bashing them for about 6 years now. So not in any way to sound ungrateful to the beautiful setting that I'm fortunate to live in and the access that I have to it, but psychologically, for the first time ever during this prep, I was finding myself getting a little bit irritable on my longer weekend runs because I wanted to just get back and crack on with some work tasks, or to make sure that I had some quality time with Erin and the dogs over the weekend, because yeah, very early mornings, very late nights throughout the process to get training and work-related stuff done. So the biggest challenge psychologically was my own scheduling, prioritization, and holding myself accountable to the plan that I'd set for the week, every single week. My relationship with alcohol has changed over the years. Having been a fairly typical university student in my younger years, I am now a lot more moderated with how I approach things, and that's where Days Brewing come in. I keep the fridge stocked with their alcohol-free lager and pale ale, so that whenever I have that proverbial British itch for a pint after a long day, a long training session, a long week, whatever it might be, I can reach into the fridge and have an icy cold Days. And interestingly, my brother Jamie, who is an avid pint drinker, said he didn't really get it until we hosted a run club here at the office, where he witnessed people cheersing Days and socializing over it whilst not having the alcohol. That for him was a real turning point, and he now sips them at 2 in the afternoon in the office, strangely. But ultimately, that's exactly what it is. It is a substitute for a lot of the ceremony that goes with a beer, which is oh so popular here in the UK, without actually having any of the negative effects of alcohol, like cognitive decline, sleep performance, athletic performance, all down regulated. So if you're looking to optimize for those things, then you can use the code MODERNMIND20 at checkout to save yourself 20% off your order with Days Brewing, and give them a go for yourself. Question from Remy Talia. What was the most difficult moment in this run? Rannoch Moor. So I went up and recce part of the route, Rannoch Moor was part of it, in mid-February. And when I did this section, it was beautiful, covered in snow, just a stunning day. Didn't see a soul the whole route and absolutely loved it. But what the snow did was effectively disguise underfoot, which meant that I was expecting a nice open cruisy section where I could make up some time and get into a good rhythm with Jamie, who was supporting me on the event itself. But in reality, it was either loose scree or like packed loose rocks as cobbles. So with the way my feet were, because I had trench foot developing at this point, effectively, I was expecting quite an open section, and it actually became really, really quite painful underfoot, because there were effectively so many pressure points, like narrow little sharp cobbles just nailing my feet when they were already in trouble. And this sort of stemmed up from my feet into my hips and my whole body and just sent me into a spiral emotionally, because it wasn't what I expected. There was a 2 mile steady uphill section before the sort of rolling bit. And once we got to the end of the uphill section, the biggest challenge then was that with a head torch on in the middle of the night, it's very difficult to discern uphill, downhill, flat. And essentially my rule for this was walk the uphills, run the flats and the downhills. Walk them aggressively, albeit, but to conserve energy and maximize the relative relationship between heart rate, pacing and effort and sort of self-preservation, that was the way that I approached things. but it was very difficult to tell when it was an incline, decline, or flat. So that on Rannoch Moor, coupled with the middle of the night, coupled with the fatigue, coupled with the fact that I'd gone into it expecting it to be one thing and was actually, ironically, dare I say, looking forward to it. And it was then not what I expected, which sent me completely the other way because I was quite emotionally battered at this point. So that was the slowest relative to distance section, and the one where I stopped started the most, the one where I was in the most pain, and the one where I really had the worst time emotionally and physically. So Rannoch Moor, maybe I'll only ever visit it when it's covered in snow at this point, because as it stands, I still don't like it very much. And ironically, actually, it is the most beautiful section of the whole West Highland Way, arguably. And we did it in the middle of the night. So, brilliant. Question from Dinesh K. Jassal. When the pain comes, what helps you focus on the mission? So I did a YouTube video on this the night before that I started, essentially my why for things like this. And it stems down to the fact that from 2014 to 2016, I suffered from depression and total silence. And I did that because of my warped perception of masculinity and my definition of success being misaligned with actually how I wanted to be living my life. But I held myself very accountable to those two definitions. And that led me down a path that ultimately became one of self-punishment in many ways. And that led me towards a suicide attempt in May of 2016, which I'm very fortunate to come out the back end of. So since then, I've effectively got a new lease on life. I've got a new perspective on life. I've got another chance. And what I realized is how much value there is into willingly exposing myself to my vulnerabilities, wrestling with myself and trying to overcome them on my own terms so that I can apply that to my day-to-day life and equip my toolbox with experiences and lessons that make me better as an individual in my day-to-day life, in my athletic life, my personal life, whatever it may be. And the self-exploration and acting upon childish curiosity that comes with these events is what drives me forwards. If something feels exciting and makes me curious as to whether I can do it or it's going to be an adventure, then it's something I'll commit to. If it's something that I feel I should be doing, or something that I feel might benefit the business, or something I feel that might be good to tick a box, I'm not going to be excited about it, and therefore I probably won't do it. So for me, it's a gratefulness for still being here, a gratefulness to still have the ability to do these things, and a gratefulness to have the ability to push myself to the absolute top end of what I'm capable of to learn the lessons along the way. I think it's a form of accelerated self-development. Have I crossed the threshold into potentially taking the piss with quote-unquote health and fitness? Potentially. Obviously, I'm covering big distances, lifting heavy weights, and sort of working quite hard on a week-by-week basis. But I love it. I love it. I love the community we're building. I love what it gives me personally. It makes me better. It forces me to ask questions that I might not have asked for another couple of years. And I've already had a close call. So the way I view my existence is maximize experiences, maximize lessons learned, and grab life by the cojones is all I'll say. Question from Anza Kumar. Do you do any stretching / poses, or how do you release / relax your muscles? Do you just sit and rest? Yes, I just sit and rest. Drink coffee, sugary foods, make silly, dark, humorous jokes with the team, complain a little bit, be quite self-deprecating and British, go, right, well then, and then get up and limp off into the night is kind of the brief. So simple as that, really. Question from Hans Grobes _WSM. How do you recover after such an epic run? Well, first of all, key buzzword is rest. Recovery and rest have become strangely disconnected in the fitness industry in recent times, but they are inextricably linked. And I didn't do a week of ice baths or massage guns every morning or Normatec boots on my eyeballs or anything like that. It was all a case of just giving myself, as I always do with these big events, 2 weeks of what I call going with the flow, whereby if I feel the urge to do 3 sets of 15 pec flies, some press-ups and some pull-ups, I'll go in and do it and just keep everything low intensity, low volume. If I feel the urge to do some light, low intensity, steady state cardio, I'll do it. But it'll all be just for the sake of enjoyment and blood flow. But rest, prioritizing sleep, prioritizing nutrition quality, prioritizing hydration, prioritizing workload to make sure that I'm not pushing myself too hard too soon is the absolute key. I was trying to get 10 hours of sleep a night for the first week and trying to do that in the second week as much as possible. Kept alcohol to a minimum, made sure that hydration electrolytes were up to date, catching up on vegetables as much as I could, because let's just say my micronutrient density during the event itself was not particularly high. But there's no hacks, there's no tricks of the trade. It was just standard rest and recovery, executing the basics as well as I could, because not only physical recovery, but mental recovery. So keeping things as simple as possible, I find, is the best way to be able to bounce back. But it's very important not to throw yourself straight into something headfirst too quickly, because I've made that mistake before, and that can put you on your ass for a long period of time. I did record a YouTube video on this in detail. It's live on my main channel. So if you want to flesh that one out more, head there. Question from Matthew.Forks. When you're pushing your limits physically and come up against the wall mentally, how do you continue? So similar to the question from before, but essentially I do my best to calm down. And that might sound a little bit simple, but often when I find that I've hit a wall mentally, it's because my emotions have spiked, I've hit a bit of a peak, and I need to bring myself back down towards something that's a bit more level. And that is often closing my eyes, taking a second, not moving, just getting my breath under control, appreciating my surroundings, thinking about things that are important to me, letting all of that emotion settle, getting rid of that tension, and just thinking about how I can practically move forwards. And if I need to dilute that down to something as simple as take one step forwards more, and then I put my head back in my hands, then that's what it needs to be. But whenever I find myself hitting a wall mentally these days, with ultra endurance events specifically, it's a mental barrier that often, by just bringing myself back to level and calming myself down, will be the way to move forwards. Another technique that Johnny and I have always used and was taught to us by a good friend of mine, Doug Crawford, who's currently qualifying his PhD in sports psychology, he taught us an ABC method, which is essentially you're going to spend most of your time at a B, sometimes you're going to be sat at an A, and then sometimes you're going to be in a C. An A is when you're feeling absolutely phenomenal, God's gift, you're having a great time. B is when you're sort of just cruising, getting on with it. And C is when you're having a terrible, terrible time. And I think on this event, I actually discovered a D as well, but that was only momentarily. But when I find myself in a C, I will vocalize that with those around me or even just to myself to try and get myself back to a B. I'm not going to be naive and ignorant and think I can just fast track my way back to an A, but if I can spend as much time in the B as possible, that keeps me level, that keeps me steady, that keeps me pragmatic, and that will keep me moving forwards. And ultimately, this event is simple. It is about continuing to move forwards. Question from Reese Turnbull. How many times did you go number two? Two across the whole weekend, which is remarkable, really. I'd say my food quality wasn't particularly lending itself to positive bowel function or movements, but that's because it was for a function to keep me moving forwards. And thankfully, I never found myself caught out in a situation where I was panicking a little bit. What I will say, however, is because I spent so much of the first 24 hours soaked through, that I developed nappy rash. So sorry to be graphic, but ironically, I went into the bathroom for the first time and basically aggravated nappy rash that had developed over the previous however many hours, and left having had a terrible time, and then was in pain for an extended period of time off the back of that. So that was a bit of a morale dip for me, because I kind of thought, you know what, there's going to be some relief from this, I'm going to feel much better. No, I'm bleeding out of my arsehole. So there you are. You asked, you listened. Sorry for that information, but it's not all glamour and cinematic montages, my friends. Question from Cam Wilson underscore 1998. How do you deal with long solo stints during ultras? My head wobbled a bit with it on my first. So very good question. Something I struggled with on the canal, as I've already referenced. What I've already mentioned is the people that popped up along the way that I interacted with gave me a real, real boost, which just goes to show how much damage being on your own for that long can do if you don't keep your head under control and keep yourself level. So key thing is I always go into any long run and any long event with planned things to think about. And for me, that was actually a whole load of structural business things that I wanted to try and unpack in my own time. I had essentially 10 hours of uninterrupted time to myself along the canal, which is not an opportunity that I get very often. So I thought I'd try and unpack these things in my head as I went, really reflect on what I wanted to do differently after this process had come to an end, what I could have done differently during the process itself in terms of what wasn't good for me, what made me feel a bit less happy, what I maybe got wrong. And that's a good way to just sort of keep yourself stimulated. But even with that, I will admit how much value it gave me when I saw other people. For example, we had the wintering intake with Omnia doing their 12 hours max distance over that weekend, and there was a girl called Chelsea who was running from Glasgow through to Edinburgh that I knew I was going to bump into from the sort of wintering group chat. But when we bumped into each other halfway, what was so, so awesome was to hear that she'd never ran more than 8K before she had started the wintering intake with us, and she had just crossed the 50K mark and she was continuing to run all the way to the 85K mark to Edinburgh, which was just so class for me to hear that we'd helped her experience that process, and so great for me to know that I was out there suffering with somebody else. So this time, what I suffered with on the canal and the rest of it with more than I did with the double Brutal per se is the lack of that, which is what Chelsea gave me that no one else did the whole time, was a bit of a sense of in-person suffering and solidarity. The double Brutal, there were other people doing the event, and I'd occasionally sit with them on the bike and we'd sort of just be like, oh, isn't this hard? Oh, what terrible decision making. And then we'd sort of move on. Whereas this was all off my own back, and I had the support team. We were all tired, we're all loopy. Jamie covered, I think, just under 100K total in the end as well. Fair play to him, but he wasn't quite as beaten up as I was. So it was just good to know that the wintering intake were doing this all over the world, and there was a bit of suffering solidarity there, but it was difficult to have faith in that during the actual event itself, where I just felt like I was just on my own. So events, lean into the people around you. If you find yourself in groups or you find yourself at aid stations, really tap into that human interaction. Plan what you're going to think about and acknowledge how you respond to things emotionally, so that next time you can prepare for them in your head a little bit more, because we can't control a lot of things, but what we can control is how we respond to things. So keeping your emotions under control is what I think ultra endurance trains us to do at its core. So the more exposure to these things you have, the better prepared you'll be for next time. If you're doing a self-supported event like I was, then yeah, you're going to need to plan a little bit more diligently, because you can't tap into that. There's somebody to my left and to my right that's doing the same thing as me, and we can all suffer in solidarity together. So a few things to bear in mind there, but yeah, it's a head wobble is fairly standard, but something that can be trained and developed over time. Question from the poached Meg. Do you fear the never, quote unquote, enoughness of these challenges, i.e. marathon, 50K, 100K, 250K, Ironman, double Ironman? No, not really. It's a good question. It's a kind of an obvious question, is where does the rings and the ladder stop? But I am very at peace with my decision-making, what I want from life, what I want from this process, the sort of cycle of ultra endurance to speed and strength stuff that I'm sort of bouncing from year to year. I'm really enjoying. And essentially, I won't do anything that isn't fulfilling, fruitful, or gets me excited in the morning. I don't really have any desire to do anything bigger in a single stage than that. I think if I'm what I want to achieve in the future, maybe for a few years down the line, is a lot of A to B landmark bucket list things. Like, I'd love to swim the Channel, I'd love to run Land's End John O'Groats, I'd love to cycle Land's End John O'Groats, I'd love to maybe swim across the Irish Channel, whatever it might be. But what I want to do with these things is I want to try and involve other people and make it an adventure that we can all share in. I'm not that interested in doing silly shit on my own anymore, to be honest. I love the community that we're building, that's kind of as much about self-development and forward motion as it is about fitness. And the never enoughness of these is I'm not that arsed about how long certain things take me. If it's self-driven, I'm not competing against anyone but myself. I'll obviously hold myself accountable to standards, but for the most part, it doesn't make me worried for the future. There was a point a few years ago where it did, but triathlon, great example. Since the double Brutal, I've decided, you know what, I need a break from triathlon psychologically, because it's not really as fulfilling for me as it once was, because I kind of ruined it for myself with the demand of the double Brutal. But I'm already getting a bit of an itch to really looking forward to sitting in a tri position and just blasting along the East Coast a few times over the summer. Does that mean it'll reignite my passion for it and I'll pick it up next year? Maybe. Does it matter if it does or not? No, not really, because I've got plenty of years left, I hope. And it means that I can develop the value that I extract from these things along the way for intrinsic gain, but also what I'm really excited about doing is bringing other people along that journey. And that is more difficult to do if that requires climbing Everest, for example. So I also think there's a lot that can be done on home soil before we need to go and do Badwater or anything like that. I think there's a few bucket list races like that I'd love to do. Leadville, Badwater, Moab. Those would be great. But I think in terms of self-supported stuff, Maybe it's just because it's a bit fresh. As it stands, I don't really have much desire to go any bigger than that. I think 50 hours of awakeness and movement and chaos is probably enough. But I'm not that fussed about specific metrics in general terms until there's a set of specific metrics that gets me excited. And there currently is, which will be what I'm training for next. But that will arrive soon. So in short, no, it doesn't worry me long term. It did at one point, but I've worked through that. But it's not an ever ascending scale. It's a constant adaptation and sort of diversion towards what makes me excited, and that will change because I will continue to change week by week, month by month, as we all do. Question from Helen Evans. What did you eat post run? So first things first, I had a, what are they called, McCrispy chickens now, whatever's replaced the Chicken Legend, large meal, and the milkshake machine was working. Win. We went the following day as well, and it wasn't working. So that's that. Fort William's pretty limited in terms of access, by the way, hence the double trip to McDonald's. And then that was Sunday afternoon after we finished. I went back and had a quite upsetting bath because I fell asleep, like fully fell asleep in the bath. I've never done that before. Where Erin opened the door to check I was still alive, and I was properly like, whoa, I was asleep, not just dozing. So that was a bit worrying, but it was a shallow bath, so fear not. It was also freezing, so the fact that I'd fallen asleep in the bath to the point where the water was, I was shivering when I woke up was again, potentially quite concerning, but play silly games, win silly prizes, I guess, entirely my own fault. Then we went to Black Isle Brewery as a team for a couple of pints and some pizzas, and that was brilliant. Really, really enjoyed it. Pizzas were great, pints were great, and it was just really good to sit in a normal setting with the team and just kind of laugh about the stupidity of what had gone down. We were all puffy, hazy, eyes weird and bloodshot. It was just funny. It was just funny. And those are the moments that really give it the value. I really enjoyed that food because it was real substance-based food rather than on the move out of a packet stuff. And the following day was kind of just eat whatever is in front of me. And then from Tuesday onwards, I made a conscious effort to get as much micronutrition in as possible. But first meal, McDonald's large McCrispy chicken with some, I think, stole some of Erin's nuggets as well. Can't really remember. Memory's still a bit hazy. And then pizza and pints at the Black Isle Brewery with some cheesy garlic bread as well, which slapped. So if anyone's ever in Fort William, would highly recommend the New England IPA and the pepperoni pizza. Enjoy. Question from Meelns. How many pairs of socks did you use? So six, I believe. I changed them after the canal. I changed them after the really boggy section. I changed them in Rau Ardennen car park. I changed them at the Bridge of Orkney. And I changed them at King's House. So however many that was. But essentially, the problem that I was dealing with was trench foot, because I was changing my socks slower than my feet were able to dry. So every time I changed my socks, whilst they were dry, my feet remained, for want of a better phrase, moist, which meant that I kind of developed trench foot. So blisters per se weren't actually the issue. It was the fact that my feet became very, very puffy and trench footy. And then my skin sort of folded in on itself, which meant that that then just kind of tore itself from that fold outwards, which kicked off really at the Bridge of Orkney and what was, yeah, a mess for a couple of days afterwards. So that was as a result of the bogginess from basically Mulgai to Drimmen. To be fair, the whole way from Mulgai to Rau Ardennen car park was just so boggy. There was actually a point where I was just below my knee in a bog because my foot had just gone right through it. I had my pole sort of up on a bank and I was trying to pull myself out, but actually just couldn't. And all I could feel was a real aggressive pull on my Achilles as I was trying to get my foot out. It was like 1, 2, 3 minutes of me giving it a go, taking a breath, like holding my breath to try and like squeeze it out of there. And I thought, am I going to have to call them to come and help me out? It was like quicksand in movies. And then eventually I sort of wriggled it out, just kind of pushed through the little pull on my Achilles, hoping it wasn't going to snap, and did get it out of there. But I had to like sidestep down the hills in that section because it was so slippy and slidey and muddy that with even with football boots on, I would have just put my foot in and all the ground would have come away from under me. So that was really, really tough physically, mentally, especially because it was pissing down with rain at the time, like torrential rain overnight for 4 or 5 hours on my own. And from that point onwards, I couldn't get my feet dry again, basically. And that's where the trench foot came from. But changing socks feels great and is a huge thing that you should try and do. You should try and keep your feet dry. That's always easier said than done, but it doesn't mean that you should be afraid of getting them wet. But when you get the opportunity to get them dry again, within reason, as long as you're not doing it every 15 minutes, then it's something that would probably help, because I've had trench foot develop through an ultra endurance event now. And it's not fantastic. So there we are. Change your socks, kids. There's your lesson. Question from Jamie Burns dot transformation. I'm assuming transformation coach or something. I can't see the full username. But as the wins and challenges get bigger, do the wins feel the same? So I think there's two answers to this. When it comes to shorter effort or heavier stuff, yes, because there's a sort of big surge in effort that's over quite quickly, and you can sort of lean into that emotion because it's quite momentary. And so things like the strongman event, things like the 500-pound deadlift and a mile under 5 minutes attempt, that sort of event, I can really, really celebrate as a win in the moment or whatever the outcome might be. Whereas endurance events, the win is getting to the start line. And then it's the process that unfolds then is kind of where the lessons and reflections really come from. So I don't get to the finish line of things like this, like the double brutal, and think, wow, yes, woo, let's go, woo. High-fiving medals, boom, headbutting walls. It's none of that. It's kind of a cathartic process in many ways where the win has already happened. So I think it depends on the discipline and the nature of the execution. But yeah, as I've said, what I'm driven to is what gets me excited and out of bed in the morning and what is appeasing my own curiosity. So anything that does that is a win for me, and that still feels the same, which is great. But as I was saying, a huge part of what I want my wins to be this year and beyond is involving more people in these silly things and going on a journey with other people, because I have reaped so much reward from doing it myself over the years. Barefoot shoes are very popular right now, and for good reason. And I'd like to draw your attention to one specific brand, which is Vivo Barefoot. For the simple reason, first of all, that they are not the sort of five-finger shoes that can often put people off giving them a go, but rather provide a wide range of models for you to choose from, all with a very similar premise, that they are wide, they are thin, and they are flexible. They allow you to interact with the floor, build your foot strength as per a university study out of Liverpool, where you can increase your foot strength by up to 60% simply by wearing them for day-to-day activities. That was Krista Oot and Rory Curtis in 2021, if you want to look that one up. I've been wearing them since 2020 and have never looked back. I'm in them 90% of the time and practically live in the Novus day to day, and then will wear the Motus strength for my training sessions. If you'd like to give them a go, then you can give Fergus 20 a go, as that code gets turned on and off. And if that one doesn't work, then use Fergus Vivo to save yourself 15% off at checkout. And do please let me know how you get on social media. Question from Jake X Smith. Did any food bring you out of a hole? If so, what? So I made 4 deli chicken, mayo, caramelized onion chutney, mature cheddar, and rocket bagels that I left at the house and didn't bring with me. And I was really looking forward to them. And I was looking forward to them even more when I got to Rowerden and Car Park and had my first... No, that's not true. When I got to Twecker and had my first sandwich, which was kindly bestowed upon me by Scott and Sam, who had their own sandwiches, and because I'd forgotten mine, I was given one, kindly. That really picked me up. Whether it was just some substance in my stomach that wasn't almost entirely fast-acting sugars, or whether it was just because it was savoury, whatever it might have been, or whether it was the sheer generosity of them giving me a sandwich, I don't know. But that really picked me up and made me think, right, I want a sandwich of sorts at every single stop. The one at Rowerden and Car Park in the morning hit really, really well as well, which meant that when Erin arrived with the dogs on Saturday night at King's house, I knew the bagels would be with her. And because I'd made the bagels myself, because it was a labor of love that went into it, and because I knew they were going to be delicious, I was thinking about those bagels. And when I had that at King's House, I had two of them, and they were delicious, dare I say so myself, and that really picked up my morale to be able to get out onto the Devil's Staircase with Johnny and get into a really solid rhythm. So having reliable, savory, more substantial foods on things like this is very important. But what's also important is that you remember to take them out of the fridge and take them with you. So let that be a lesson to us all. But things like this, it's important to, yeah, whether it's an Ironman, whether it's an ultra, whatever it may be, it's testing and trialing and training over a long period of time what works. Don't just assume performance nutrition like gels and electrolytes and carbs and things like that are going to last, because your palate will get fatigued. You'll start to hate certain things. It'll be difficult to get down fluids because your body's just like, no, please don't give us any more tropical flavored juice. No. And you might not want to have another gel. You might want to have a bag of crisps. So trying those things and seeing what lands well is very important. And the best place to do that is in training. Question from Anya.Waters. When can we buy the Omnia hat? Very soon. Don't worry. We have had a lot of those questions. There are several more of those questions in this questions box. Soon. Fear not. Fear not. That was a pretty good wear test for them, dare I say so, myself. Question from Jack Price_15. What happened with Ben Nevis? So, very simple, really. Winter conditions from 850 meters up. Very, very icy. We had to rent B2 boots and crampons ahead of time in anticipation. And on the Sunday morning, we made the decision that effectively, given that I was stumbling about, slurring my words, speaking like an idiot, Johnny was kind of doing the same, the rest of the team were kind of doing the same, Jamie was bleeding between his thighs because of chafing, Scott and Sam, the camera guys, were delirious, Elliot was delirious, Mountain Rescue had told us in detail about what the conditions were like, what we should have expected. We had Mac from Nomad Mountaineering with us, who was kind of erring on the side of caution. We felt it would have crossed the threshold into recklessness for a team in our state to go up Nevis in icy winter conditions. Do we have the expertise and ability to do it at the best of times? Absolutely. Do we have the expertise and ability to do it after 48 hours of movement and no sleep? When we're filming something, we're thinking about getting to the end, we're all delirious, tired, and maybe not as focused as we would be? Not sure. So because there was a doubt, we decided that effectively we wouldn't have been sending a good message if we went up Nevis in those conditions, with the snow line being at 850 meters, which meant there was basically just under 400 meters of snow and ice with crampons, boots, and even maybe an ice axe required, which, whilst it would have been gnarly, great for content, and I'm confident I could have done it, would have been slow, albeit, it could have been a terrible decision. It, I think, would have crossed the line into recklessness on premise, and yeah, we could have got up and down without any sort of issue, but had we gone up and had an issue, that would have been our own faults and would have been a really bad message to send to the outdoors community, to ultra endurance, to everyone. So we put any ego or attachment to it to the side. 250 kilometers was always the goal. I just chose that route as a way of getting there through an area that I loved. Would I have loved to finish at Ben Nevis? Yes. Were the circumstances befitting of doing that? No. Am I completely at peace with it? Yes. If you're going to be doing anything in Scotland at a higher level, whether it's the Keltman, whether it's Nevis, whatever it is, at any time of year, you need to run the risk that the top end, that the tops of the peaks are going to be inaccessible because Scotland will throw some shit at you fairly regularly. It's been raining for about 4 months. So hopefully that clears things up. Fairly clear. I mean, I've said it across platforms as well, but I think some people are still sort of wondering, oh, what happened? It was just a practical decision based on safety for the most part. And I'm very pleased that we all made that decision without any real friction as a team, having the expertise that we did, because it could have been easy for me to be like, nah, let's charge up. We said we were going to do this. Let's do that. It'd be so cool to get this at the top and all that. 250 kilometers was the goal. So I made it up at a lower level and finished in the bridge from Ben Nevis car park to the bottom of the mountain path, which is still very, very much a part of my journey over the years, part of Johnny's journey over the years, and felt as good a place to finish as anywhere. Question from AJC_coaching. Top three tips for hybrid athlete coaches. Not enormously relevant to this Q&A, but I thought I'd address it anyway whilst we're on the topic. Number one, know what hybrid training actually is. Key detail. There are a lot of coaches out there that are talking about hybrid training that don't necessarily actually understand its origins or the parameters in which it operates. So I think that's really quite important to keep the phrase alive and to stop the people that are getting irritated by the term online from having any ammo. Number two is understand energy systems and stressors and fatigue management that's at play, and don't just splice things together and call it hybrid. There is a methodology and a set of scientific principles that need to be understood to be able to apply things. It's not just a case of pairing running and bro lifting. And essentially, if hybrid training is the pursuit of progression in multiple disciplines that don't inherently support one another, then you need to work to optimize the suboptimal. And can somebody make progress in their running and lifting at a recreational level? Absolutely. Can somebody work towards top end difficult 5K times alongside heavy deadlifts? A little bit more difficult. And that's where the nuance comes in. Number three is understand that fatigue masks fitness, which is where as fatigue from strength and endurance training accumulates over time, they will mask your ability in a day-by-day basis to actually output the metrics that might indicate your current level of fitness. And that's where tapering and deloading will essentially reveal that. And that big heavy cloak of fatigue that is masking your current ability will remove itself from you, and your fitness will reveal itself. So there we are, a non-250 kilometer related question chucked in the middle of it, just because I thought it was quite topical. Question from Nick underscore Crads. How did the 250 kilometers feel? How much sleep did you get, if any? It felt awful for the most part. there's far too many feelings and emotions to answer that one succinctly, but what I will answer succinctly is how much sleep did you get, if any? I slept for 30 minutes at Rawadenen car park at about 7 in the morning on Saturday. So that was about 22 hours deep. I slept for half an hour on the front seat of the car and then got moving from Rawadenen through to Invesnade, and then from Invesnade through to Inveranen. And that sleep was quite rejuvenating, and it was a proper... It was the first time ever where Johnny's woken me up in the front seat of a car during an event, and I've been woken up like, oh, I was asleep there. Double Brutal, I slept for 12 minutes total. And when I got woken up, I was like, no, let me sleep first. And I'm like, no, you've had your eyes closed for 12 minutes. I'm like, ah, bollocks. So like I described earlier, when I fell asleep in the bath after the event, this was a proper like, oh, you were asleep. And I felt great from that moment onwards. So no sleep on the second night. Would I have benefited from sleep on the second night? Probably. But I focused on forward motion instead. So essentially up at 5 in the morning on Friday, slept for 30 minutes on Saturday morning at about 7 a.m. and then didn't get to sleep again until 8 p.m. on Sunday night. So bit weird. Stephen Jones, if you could relive one moment from the whole experience, what would it be? It would be turning up to the Green Welly, wondering where the team were, and then being beckoned over to the pub around the corner where they had a steak pie and chips waiting for me, as everybody that wasn't driving was sinking a pint. Including, dare I say, and this is a bit reckless and I probably shouldn't reveal this, Jamie, who still had 30 kilometres to run with me. But he says, it was a result of peer pressure, and I think the peer pressure was, Jamie, would you like a pint? So it was just such a novelty for me to be, A, pissed off that I thought they were late to the Green Welly, where we were meant to be meeting, to then have that flipped on its head and be beckoned over for a hot meal waiting for me at a picnic bench in a beer garden where they were all having pints on a Saturday afternoon when we were all delirious and weird. Very funny, felt normal amidst what was a very abnormal experience. And I think it was quite odd for people watching me sit down with a few cameras floating around and then getting up and sort of running back onto the West Highland Way. Must have been quite confusing for those people. So just boys being boys, you know, boys being boys. Question from Joshua James Holland. Are you happy with what you achieved? It's some achievement. Well done. Thank you very much. Yes, absolutely. What I'm not particularly happy with is my memory of it in that I've seen the first draft of the full video that's going live on Sunday. Today is Wednesday. And that has really helped me re-jog my memory of a lot of what happened. But there's still sort of patchy gaps where I can kind of remember the visuals, but I can't really remember how I felt or the conversation. So having the video bring that back to life for me was really quite special. So obviously I'm not unhappy about it. I'm like, oh, what have I done wrong? But it's just kind of It was an amazing experience. It was a life-changing experience. It was good fun with the boys upon reflection. And I'm so bewildered with myself to have gone from a meathead powerlifter who'd be out of breath walking up a flight of stairs to running 250 kilometers in one go. and understanding the sleep deprivation and the practicality and the training that goes into it. It's just the process and journey that I've been on to get to this point is remarkable, and I'm doing my best to, I don't say that arrogantly, it's like it's mind blowing to me. And like I can't quite believe that it's happened. But all that happened was one commitment to a step forwards and then continue doing that over time and delayed gratification, however many years that I've been doing this now on, here we are. And what's really exciting is that if I just keep doing that, there'll be more fun stuff that happens along the way, more lessons to be learned, more development to be had. And I'm very happy. Very happy. I think I'm hoping the full final video will really reinforce the memories for me so that I can look back on it fondly. Because I'm internally indebted to the team that supported and everything that went into it. And it is a proper bucket list thing to have achieved. Ben Nevis is a long way from Edinburgh in the car. And I ran the fucker, which is mad. So I'm going to be a miserable granddad to be around because, but back in my day when I was doing this and, sips pints and, this Cascale's dreadful. But, kids, when I ran from... I'm probably going to be like that. So I'm also moving to Yorkshire and adopting the accent as well, apparently. I don't know why that's what came to me, but here we are. Question from Lucas Zilleri. Hardest kilometre, 189. That was the final flat section on Rannoch Moor before you drop down into Glencoe. Fuck me. I was in a bad way. Jamie can attest to this. Bad, bad way. Just so much pain from my feet upwards. Mentally, I was shot. The darkness was bullying me. I couldn't comprehend how I had such a long way to go. Just so many things at play. I was really, really peak misery at that point. I'd been going for about 38 hours at this point. About 37, 38 hours at this point. And 189 to 190 was just brutal. What was really pissing me off was the amount of effort required to cover such a short distance so slowly, which meant that every little bout of effort that I put in felt like I achieved nothing, which just put me further and further down the spiral. So I was in a bad, bad way until I got to King's House, saw Erin and the dogs, had some of the bagels that I'd made and were delicious, if I do say so myself, and then knew that I was going to have Johnny with me for the next section. And actually, once I got to Kinlochleven over the back end of that section, that felt pretty close to where we needed to get to. So 189 to 190, brutal. Question from benprice.bp. How long will you rest / recover before jumping back into any form of training? So it was 2 weeks of sort of making it up as I go along, but any training, quote unquote, was just blood flow and sort of movement. It wasn't training implying that I'm sort of working towards something. But today is Wednesday and I have done a lower body session and an upper body session thus far this week. I was going to go to the track last night and do some real easy 400 meter repeats, but my glute med is actually a little bit pissed off after the lower body session yesterday. So just going to sit on the assault bike later today or tomorrow, maybe, just because I do feel I want to get moving again. But actual training, like committing to a training program to move things forwards, I've kind of loosely begun, but tentatively because I need to see how I react to things. So what would normally be a 20 set total upper body session, lower body session is currently an 8 set max. So it's going to be a couple of weeks like that before I can really get things moving forwards again. But a lot of it is just going to be reacclimatizing with movements, reacclimatizing with skill work, and just getting all energy systems firing again before I commit to what's next. So there's no hard and fast answer. I need to roll with the punches on this one, but I need to become mentally prepared to accept that I might plan for one thing one day and have to adapt as I go because I'm not quite where I want to be, and that's part of the process. Question from Kenny Mark 001. Do you think recovery will take as long as the double brutal? No, because the big mistake that I made with the double brutal was that I mismanaged my mentality afterwards. So after the double brutal, I think it's fair to say that I lost my passion for triathlon as a result of pushing myself right to the edge with the prep for it. And I was very fortunate to have a place on the Norseman in the following August, which is a bucket list race. So, so grateful to have a place and so, so excited on premise to have it. However, I could not get excited for 2, 3, 4 months about training as a triathlete every day. It's a very demanding, very high frequency way of training. And I just couldn't get excited about it. And I was getting so pissed off with myself for not being excited about it because I was so grateful and fortunate to have a place in the Norseman. And that was all because I kind of had this identity that I am a triathlete who lifts heavy weights. And ultimately, what had changed as a result of getting through the double brutal was that my identity, quote unquote, had changed a little bit in the short term. And I had lost sight of the fact that the beauty of training across disciplines as a hybrid athlete is that I can determine what direction I go in. And I held on to the triathlete that lifts heavy weights for too long. And that really damaged me mentally, where I was just punishing myself for a few months. I made the difficult decision to not commit to the Norseman in March of that year. And that completely freed me up mentally to be able to really get my teeth stuck into what was next. And that was only when I actually felt fully recovered from the double brutal in terms of my application to things psychologically and physically. And from that moment onwards, I committed to my first strongman event. I committed to training for a 500-pound deadlift and mile under 5 minutes total. Ironically failed, but did in turn manage to run a sub 5 minute mile again as part of the process. So look, recovery physically is one thing, recovery mentally is another, and I think mentally it's much easier to get wrong. So I'm confident that with the tools that I've equipped myself with from getting things wrong in the past with the double brutal, I'm going to be much better off this time. So no, I don't think it will take as long as the double brutal, which is good news because it was a long time last time. Question from Ollie_Baker_18. Did you listen to anything on the run? If not, what was going through your mind? No headphones policy at all times when doing endurance events. Training is my way to view things. If I'm doing any full send treadmill stuff, I might put on a pair of headphones. I'll obviously listen to headphones if I'm lifting in the gym, but anything outdoors, endurance training, no headphones policy for me because of the value that it gives, the awareness it gives me, the peacefulness it gives me to reflect on my own thoughts and be completely away from devices is very valuable. So what was going through my mind? I can't really remember exactly. Obviously, I had things that I wanted to think about along the way. I had conversations with those around me as I was going, but I did find my mind just wandering as I went. I found myself in periods of just being really grateful for things. I found myself being a little bit, not ashamed of myself, but questioning whether I'd got everything right in the process and wishing I'd done things differently in terms of how I manage my time, how I manage weekends with Erin, things like that. And these are just peaks and troughs emotionally. So I think that's ultimately why I do things without headphones, because it forces me to go through the peaks and troughs emotionally, which is where the lessons and value lie in these things. So I might be a psychopath to some of you for doing this without headphones, but I find it quite valuable. And I think if you're the sort of person that couldn't bear the thought of running an easy 5K without headphones, I'd suggest that's something to address, because that is a dependency. And I believe there is benefit to releasing yourself from that dependency. But in no way to judge, just something I've seen and had conversations with people on. So I thought I'd bring it up because I'm massively biased and think there's value in doing it without headphones. The end. Question from David Giles, 41. Did you regret doing the deadlifts during the week? Great achievement. Congrats. Thank you very much. No, didn't regret it at all. Very, very pleased to have hit a 250 kilo deadlift the same week as a 250 kilometer ultramarathon. I don't believe there's probably many people that can or could or have had the ability to be able to do that, which isn't a sort of competitive thing for me, but it is a source of pride. I've worked very hard over the years to maintain my strength and sort of build it back up after powerlifting alongside the ultra endurance stuff, and being able to piece things together like that is a skill I've developed through the years of taking on things that are very much like that. One heavy single in terms of systemic fatigue, yeah, it'll contribute a little bit. I did it on the Monday before the Friday kickoff, but I did one heavy single and that was that. In terms of actual physical fatigue, it's not like my hamstrings are going to be tight or my glutes are going to be fried going into it. It was a single. If I'd done 100 reps at 180 kilos, yeah, I would have been a bit mince going into Friday, but that would have been a bit pointless. So no, 250 kilo deadlift the same week as a 250 kilometer ultramarathon. Very silly, very entertaining, very hybrid in the sense that the concurrent training of disciplines that do not inherently support one another and whose disparate components are not essential to success at any one sport. Top end strength, ultra endurance. Ultra endurance doesn't make you better at top end strength. Top end strength doesn't make you better at ultra endurance. Therefore, ergo, hybrid. Question from Imri Fitness. At what point in the 250 kilometers did you think shit just got real? The end of the canal. In fact, it was actually the end of the canal, the section from the end of the canal to Mulgai. It just dragged on like fucking mad. Honestly, I was so pissed off in that section. I'm pissed off now thinking about it. It was kind of like the end of the canal was, oh, we're here, we're done. That's the first third done. And then there was this kind of annoying suburban rolling hills alongside main road section that was just shit. And I just didn't enjoy it. And I thought, oh my God, you're only a third of the way through. It's dark. You're pretty beaten up. What on earth is going on? This was a terrible idea. Switch your head back on because you got a long way to go. So, yeah, that was that. That was a rude awakening for me. Question from Chris Chavez Cronin. Were you confident you complete the distance before you started? Did this change during? So, yes, I was confident I had the distance in me. My mindset with this was always, if I am confident in my ability to run 100 miles, then I can do this. It's just a case of suffering through the remaining 55. And in the past, I've been able to run 100 miles on back-to-back 30Ks, alongside, obviously, cumulative aerobic volume building up to that point. But given that I hit a big back-to-back 40K, 50K as part of the process, I knew that I was in a really good place. And I backed myself on suffering and ability to push through sleep deprivation and have an awareness of what all that felt like more than I would have done had I not done stuff like this before, I guess. Obviously, there was doubt. There's a lot of variables at play. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's a big unknown. And that's why I did it in the first place. Did it change during? Yes, absolutely. My confidence was sapped after the canal. My confidence was sapped and tested with the section from Inversnaid to Inveranen. Oh my God, that section was bad. It was unrunnable and borderline unwalkable at points, at the best of times, let alone with 140K on your feet. Good Lord. Anyway, 151K, I've already mentioned, was an absolute volter in the story, where I had head in hands and north end of Loch Lomond, really had to have a harsh word with myself. But yeah, essentially ahead of time, the question was, can I run 100 miles? If the answer is yes, through training, then have at it, figure it out as you go. Once I was in it, that's where the challenges were presented, but we always knew that would be the case. So I couldn't have prepared to run 155 miles in the same relative scale that you would prepare for 100 miles in terms of volume, mileage, time committed per week, because it would have just been ridiculous. And the same applies to the double Brucell. I think people assume that I just double Ironman prep, but that would have been 35 hours a week. Same with this. If I was running 100 mile weeks back to back to back to back on top of strength training and top of running the businesses, I wouldn't have had any sleep and I would have lost my mind. So it's a case of being sensible and pragmatic and intelligent with programming, especially whilst trying to maintain my strength, which is where it's about turning up certain dials, turning down certain dials, acknowledging weaknesses, acknowledging strengths, acknowledging experience, and focusing on the right things rather than focusing on everything, which is where we really like to sort of direct our programming style at Omnia. So there we are. Question from Eric Aubrey. Can you talk through your fuel from the run? Maybe what you would have changed. Thanks. So fuel strategy was basically have electrolytes and carbs on my person at all times so that I was tripling down on carbohydrate source, electrolyte source, and water source all at once. That's my tactic for everything, whether it's triathlon, ultra endurance. It's just, it's more bang for your buck in terms of space and practicality. It means that you don't need to carry water and then electrolyte tablets and then gels all at once. Obviously you can carry those things supplementary, but it means that you're sort of tripling down. Along with that, I just had a wide selection of fast acting carb sources available to me at all times. I had a wide selection of savory stuff like crisps, sandwiches, and other bits and bobs. We had pastries. It was basically a kind of a seafood diet. If I see the food, I eat the food. But what I did struggle with was I wish I'd had more access to sort of more wholesome, hot, savory food more regularly. Sandwiches were life-changing for me, and the hot meal that I had, the steak pie and chips that I had on Saturday late afternoon, early evening, was genuinely rejuvenating. So I think having mealtime savory, more wholesome foods ready to go in Tupperware pre-cooked would have been useful. But in my planning, I sort of just chose bagels and sandwiches that were pre-made that were a bit easier. But I think I would have sacrificed a little bit of ease and convenience ahead of time for a little bit more morale-boosting food during. But you can't really science your way through this too much because you've got to deal with the human side of things, being awake for 50 hours and getting food continuously down you so that you've got 60 grams of carbs an hour on top of fluids and electrolytes. You can't just make a list and stick to it. Your body's going to say, don't you fucking dare put another crisp in your mouth because it will start bleeding, or your cheeks and tongue become a bit furry with this weird carbohydratey, sugary layer that's just horrible. Your stomach might give you GI issues. You might really struggle to get water down. You might feel really sloshy because of electrolytes. You need to be prepared and have options, but you need to roll with the punches. Obviously, you want to refine what's expected with the training process. But yeah, I had comments ahead of time of people saying that you should be eating this, you should be eating that. Eat, make sure to have these whole foods. Make sure to have this. It's like it doesn't work like that. You can't be too practical and rational ahead of time for what is a massively variable and massively uncontrollable experience. So the best thing that you can do is have a wide range of options and act upon them as and when you find yourself in the situation that you need something, because then you're not going to fall yourself, you're not going to find yourself cut short in terms of availability, and it means that you're not going to have to force something down on you that you don't want just for the sake of being able to keep moving forwards. I did probably fall behind a little bit at certain points with my food intake, which meant that for the first, there were a lot of like 19, 20K sections. And for the first like 10, there was a bit of a pattern for a while where the first 10 to 12K of a section felt really good. And then I'd drop off a fucking cliff and feel really, really bad for the last eight, which sets my morale. I'd then get back and reconnect with the team where I'd have some more food, get a big spike, and then repeat that process. It was just because I was kind of finding myself getting lasered in and really focused and kind of not sticking to my nutrition strategy as tiredness increased, which is to be expected, but that's on me. Ultimately, accountability. I should have been more rigid on that, and I made my life more difficult than it needed to be. But that's because of the human and behavioral side of things that goes into it, that you can say you must eat every 30 minutes for 48 to 50 hours. Okay, but there's lots of things that are going to be at play there that you need to manage. So that's where leaning into the lowest hanging fruit, most convenient, easily accessible, and most tasty within the context stuff is what's going to keep you moving forwards, because it just removes the friction. But you can only remove that friction if you have a wide range of options. So if anyone's thinking of running for 50 hours, then there you go. That's your information. Final question from Ian Jack Fitness. How many hours in a week did you spend training for this? So at peak, it was about 24, 25 hours a week. And for the most part, it never dropped below 12 throughout the whole training process, really. There were bumps in the road along the way in terms of travel, workload, fatigue management, and adjustments in terms of we were trying to double up on recceing with long runs, with getting Scott and Johnny and the team there so that we could all do it together and kind of do everybody's job all at once, which meant that we had some scheduling challenges along the way, and that's changed a few things. But for the most part, it was just ticking boxes week on week. And the main thing that I was focusing on was my big weekend long runs. I was doing a lot of training without actually tracking it, because I was becoming so sick of time on laptop and phone all day, every day, that the 60 minute to 90 minute list runs that I was doing in zone two, which were boring essentially and weren't as exciting away from the sort of day to day chaos, I just didn't want to look at a screen. I just wanted to sort of be completely at peace with myself. So I don't have an exact mileage tracked, time tracked, because I wasn't uploading everything to Strava as I went, because I was only really tracking key sessions or when I felt like I could tolerate data on my wrist. Because ultimately, I've got a very good perception of my RPE and my sort of zone that I'm operating in based on feel. So I don't need a watch to tell me at all times that I'm sitting at 142 heart rate, because I can probably estimate within a couple of beats per minute where I'm sitting. So yeah, I'd say it went from 12 to 24 hours throughout the process. And I'd say, yeah, biggest week was mid-February, where I think it was 120 kilometer week. So yeah, 120 kilometer week is probably less than standard ultra runners would expect, but we don't necessarily use mileage as a metric. It's more time on feet, but also acknowledging the fact that I'm much heavier, that I have strength capacity I can apply, but also I'm managing fatigue from strength training. I'm managing fatigue from quite long work hours as well. So I can't just chuck the kitchen sink at it with everything. As I said before, it's turning up certain dials, turning down certain dials, and being sensible and intelligent with programming, not being dogmatic and arbitrary because one Reddit thread says, to be able to run this far, you must be able to do this like this. It's not how individuals work. Not how individual strengths and weaknesses work. I think people maybe put a bit too much emphasis on generalized numbers with these things, but within the context of what we're talking about today, between 12 and 24 hours and the actual mileage on a week-by-week basis, I'm not 100% sure. I can go back and check in my training peaks, but I can't be asked. So there we are. There we are. Anyway, that is that. I am sincerely apologetic to those of you that I didn't get to your questions. We had 273 of them. I don't know how many we've answered. It feels like a fair few. What time is it? 9:30 now. So we've been going for a while. Hopefully that has clarified a lot of the questions you've got. If you do have any more, please drop them in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, or put them in the Q&A section of Spotify. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, I'd suggest that you change platforms so that you can interact a little bit more. And I will do my best to get back to you in there, just so that obviously we can unpack as much of this experience together as possible. So thank you very much for listening. Make sure to check out all of the previous episodes that we have uploaded on the podcast. Is this going to be episode 99, Jamie? Oh, this probably should have been episode 100, really. Oh, well. Oh, well. The numbers haven't turned out neat this time. But what did turn out neat is a 250-kilo deadlift and a 250-kilometer run in the same week. So there we are. Thank you very much for listening, and see you next time.